it was just a very relaxed, a trusting, we didn't think about crime until this time. And things changed. Yeah, when the dog barked, you paid a little bit of extra attention. I'm Dennis Hurst, and I was the last person to leave 10050 Cielo Drive the night of August 8, 1969, that had any interaction with the victims, other than the killers, of course. I was born in Beverly Hills, so my birth certificate says Beverly Hills, California. And my family had moved to Beverly Hills shortly before I was born, right by the time my older brother was born, and lived at Camden, about three houses up from Santa Monica Boulevard, three houses north of Santa Monica Boulevard. And my mother's uncle and his wife had a very prominent bicycle store in Beverly Hills, in a very prominent location. They were childless. They were getting older, and they wanted to begin taking life easy. And my father and mother had been avid cyclists. My father was very mechanical. And so they said, why don't you come move to Southern California from San Francisco, and you can manage the bike shop so we can start taking life easier and do more traveling. And then we don't have children, so you'll inherit the bicycle business when we die. And so my parents moved to Beverly Hills in 1950. I was born, obviously, August 8, 1951. The bicycle store was called Hans Ort. That was my mother's uncle's name, Hans Ort, Lightweight Bicycles. And that was a reflection of the fact that while a lot of American bicycles in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s even were heavy, very durable Schwinn steel bicycles, the heritage of our family was very much in lightweight European style racing machines. So my grandfather, Ernst Ort, and his brother, Hans Ort, were from San Francisco, and they raced for the Olympic Club in San Francisco as amateurs, Hans winning the 1915 U.S. National Championship on a bicycle. They're both inducted into the Hall of Fame at the Olympic Club up in San Francisco. And they then turned professional and raced in Australia and in Europe starting in 1919, 1924. And when they returned from there and they wrapped up their careers in Europe, my grandfather was actually, when he stopped racing, was the coach of the U.S. Olympic cycling team in the Paris Olympics of 1924. So when they returned to San Francisco, one of their brothers said, I'm going to open up a bicycle store right here in San Francisco across from Golden Gate Park. And that was designed to rent bicycles to people, especially during the Depression and stuff. People didn't buy a lot of bicycles. They rented bicycles, and Golden Gate Park was one of the few places in San Francisco. It's great to ride a bicycle. And the other brother said, I'm going to open up my shop in this town being built near Los Angeles called Beverly Hills. And so I think in the late 20s, he opened up a shop in Beverly Hills, and then on Brighton Way, I think. And then in around 1932, the beginning of the Depression, opened up the store at that current location, the southeast corner of Camden and what we call Little Santa Monica. Maybe it's called South Santa Monica now. So it was the southeast corner there. And so that was the background of the bicycle and why the bicycles really appealed to the sort of the elite and wealthy crowd of Beverly Hills. They were European, they were handmade, they were lightweight. And the bike shop was staffed. We had, I think, six or seven different members of the U.S. Olympic cycling team over the years worked in the bike shop as salespeople or mechanics. So it really had some high standards for proficiency. And really, we sold a lot of Schwinns, great bicycle, but we also sold a lot of high-end, handmade European bicycles. So the family, we all grew up around the bicycle business. And there were four boys in the family, no girls. And we all worked in the bike shop, usually started off sweeping floors and polishing fenders, but eventually waiting on customers. It's interesting, in my family, people are always saying that, you know, why do you refer to your mom and your dad as Connie and Lynn? And that's because maybe we were as teenagers or even when we were in college, we'd be working the bike shop and we had a question from my parents, but they didn't think it was very professional. Say, hey, mom, how much is this? Or, hey, dad, what do you think of that in front of a customer? So we referred to them as Connie and Lynn so that we looked like we were more professional employees. Some really interesting times. This would have been really for me in the 60s, into the late 60s. And a lot of interesting episodes. A lot of people say, you know, what was it like, or who were some of the customers? And I'd grown up in Beverly Hills. I went to Beverly Hills Catholic School. My classmates in my grammar school class for 9 years was Dean Paul Martin Jr., Dino Martin, Dean Martin's son, and Lucy Arnaz was in my class, and a lot of interesting people. And in the bike shop, there was sort of the stars of the 1960s, late 1960s, Charles Bronson. Actually, I remember a couple of three episodes with him in the bike shop, and he was a very gruff, kind of a bull in the china shop kind of guy, and kind of barking orders to people, and frankly, being pretty rude. Maybe that was his persona, maybe that was his real personality. And he would just kind of like, yeah, okay, and I want this, whatever. And then he'd stomp out, and then he had like a private secretary, a guy that sort of followed him around, and he would be much more conciliatory. He'd say, gee, Mr. Hurst, I think Mr. Bronson would really appreciate, and could you deliver this? And is this all taken care of? And he would sort of unruffle feathers and take care of business as Bronson walked out. I remember a particularly funny episode. The bike shop had a front entrance, which is like 45 degrees angle, right on the corner of Camden and what we call Little Santa Monica. And so that was the entrance that customers would go in and out of. But we also had an entrance in the back that went into the mechanic shop. And obviously he didn't want to have people traipsing through there. So we directed traffic through the front entrance. But some people that were particularly good friends of the bike shop were certainly allowed to come in and kibitz with the mechanics and say hi and walk through the store. There was a parking lot behind the bike shop. A lot of people park there. So some people take the shortcut and go through the bike shop rather than around the building, even if they're just going to go out onto Camden or out onto Santa Monica. So one of the guys that was a good friend of the bike shop was Buddy Hackett. And so he comes into the bike shop, and he goes, hey, Mr. Hurst, talking to my father. And he said, yeah, my best friend. He said, he just had a baby. Kind of late in life for that guy to be having a baby, but he just had his first baby, and I want to take a gift to the hospital. So what do you have? Do you have some like fun tricycle? My dad said, yeah, we have a really high-end line of like German tricycles, real ball bearings, whatever they were. It was like $100. It seemed like a lot of money for a tricycle at the time. And he said, yeah, let me have that one. Let me have the red one, whatever. My dad said, well, is it a boy or a girl? He said, yeah, it's a girl. So my dad put a pink or a red bow on it. And Buddy Hackett tucks the tricycle under his arm and walks out and says, yeah, hey, thanks. Well, I was happening to be working again at the bike shop about 3 weeks later, three, 4 weeks later, and Don Rickles comes walking into the bike shop through the main entrance with this tricycle tucked under his arm with a big red bow on it. And he goes, Mr. Hurst, he said, my idiot friend, he said, he buys my little baby this gift. She can't ride this thing for 3 or 4 years. What am I gonna do with it? And my dad said, well, Mr. Rickles, Mr. Hackett paid all cash for that, so I'll give you cash out of the till, or I'll give you a credit to your account here, or I'll credit your credit card, whatever you'd like. And as he's arranging that with my father, by complete coincidence, I believe, walking in through the back mechanics entrance to the bike shop is Buddy Hackett. And he says, what are you doing? You're returning my gift. And they started kibitzing back and forth each other in this cutting, biting kind of a way. You could tell they really loved each other, and they were really good friends, and they were great spontaneous comics. I was standing at the bottom of the stairs. We had stairs up to a mezzanine. I had to sit down. I was cracking up. You would have paid money to listen to this routine at a Vegas nightclub. These guys were just really funny and really friendly and just really tough on each other. It was a style of comedy for both of them. Anyway, just lots of great stories like that. I remember Barbara Streisand pulling up at the bike shop. She wasn't going to the bike shop. She pulled up in a big Cadillac Eldorado and said, and my dad said, oh, you can't park here. because this is only for a customer. She goes, oh, I'm just going to the bank across the street. It won't be any problem. My dad said, it is a problem. And so she wasn't very nice. But there was a lot of wonderful people. One of them was Jimmy Durante. And he lived in a relatively modest house on Rodeo Drive, just north of Santa Monica. And he was a really regular customer. He also had a lot of grandkids. He was a real regular customer of the store. And the fun thing about him was he always paid, probably a matter of pride or style, he always paid for everything with $100 bills. Keep the change. So if he ever bought something, it was like $98 or $198, he'd peel off one or two $100 bills and that settled it. Of course, he always hoped it was something like for $107 and he'd peel off two $100 bills, keep the change. That happened on a number of occasions. Very, very sweet man. I also remember delivering bicycles to him and his wife, probably for the grandkids, and very, very sweet people. Really, really interesting background. One other thing that was happening right about this time in the 60s is, you know, we had these young stars coming up. Steve McQueen rode motorcycles very, very well. A lot of people remember his, probably doing a lot of his own stunts in the Great Escape. But a lot of these young actors, up-and-coming actors, were getting into car racing. And as a lot of people start with the Cooper Minis, back then, 1 liter engine. And so they would have these beautiful souped-up racing versions of Cooper Minis. I guess we call them Mini Coopers now. And it was James Garner and Steve McQueen and David McCallum and a lot of these young guys. And some people, if they pulled up, I think my dad was a little bit easier about letting them park back there. I don't remember them being big customers of the bike shop, but I definitely remember seeing their souped up Broncos, their souped up Mustangs, and their souped up Cooper Minis as a real fun and spectacular part of growing up in that environment. And this was a clientele that would often come into the bike shop, buy a bicycle, and bicycles back then, it was kind of hard to put them in the back seat of a car or put them in the trunk or whatever. So it was not uncommon, especially if somebody bought two bicycles or something like that, to ask if the store could deliver the bicycle. And so that's how my older brothers before me and myself, shortly after getting our driver's licenses at age 16, became delivery boys for Hansort lightweight bicycles and delivered to a lot of very interesting places. So the night of the murders was my 18th birthday. On my 18th birthday, I'd been to the beach with my girlfriend and a bunch of our friends in Santa Monica, Sorrento Beach, right near the Jonathan Club. And I'd come back from the beach and I went to the bike shop and I said, hey dad, it's my birthday. And I want to take my girlfriend, Janice, out to a movie for my birthday. So can I have the van? And my dad said, yes, you can borrow the van, but you have to make a delivery. It's up Benedict Canyon, and we lived up Benedict Canyon. You have to make a delivery, but you can't make the delivery right now, like 5:30, 6 o'clock on your way up the canyon to get ready, because as I understand, they're gonna be out to dinner and they won't be home until after 7:30. So you have to deliver the bicycle on your way back down the canyon on the way out to pick up Janice. She lived on Rockingham out in Brentwood. So I would drop off the bicycle. Earlier that week, on Wednesday, so that'd be August 6th, Abigail Folger and Wojciech Frykowski came into the bike shop and bought for Abigail a very nice British bike, a Raleigh. And my father delivered the bicycle that Wednesday evening on his way home up the canyon. They contacted the store either Thursday or Friday and said, hey, we got the wrong color. It's not the one that we wanted. And my dad said, no problem. I'll stop by and do the exchange this evening. And that's when they said, well, we won't be home until after dinner or whatever. And so I got assigned to do the bicycle exchange and try not to arrive until after 7:30, after they would have arrived home from dinner. So My father had been to the address, obviously, two evenings before, and he gave me directions on how to get in. He said, you're just going to pull up this long, winding driveway. There'll be a gate at the end. Stop before the gate. There'll be a bush on your left. And hidden in the bushes, you just have to feel around for it with your hand, will be a button. You push that button, and that will open the gate. And I remember driving in, and when I delivered a lot of bicycles, Anthony Quinn's home in Bel Air, and a lot of other interesting places, there would often be like a pressure plate, or like in the gas stations at the time, you drive in, it would go ding, ding. That would let the guy know in the gas station, come out and wash your windshield and check your oil and pump your gas for you back in the old days. So I was looking for something to drive over that would trigger the gate to close behind me. So I looked pretty carefully. There was no pressure plate. There was no wires or anything to drive over. I just drove in and I saw in the mirror as I was driving in that the gate just closed behind me. So I think after 60 seconds, it just closed. It was a less expensive gate. And I pulled up to the garage and opened up the van and took the correct colored bicycle out and parked it in the garage. The garage doors were open and the bicycle was in plain sight. So I took the bicycle out, put the other bicycle in, put them in the right location. So now I needed to let somebody know that I had done this. So I walked out around from the garage and across the driveway between the two parked cars and through a little gate and like a split rail fence with a gate, and then past a little wishing well and across the lawn and some flagstone stairs or to a flagstone front porch. And with a white door, I think it might've been like a Dutch door or whatever, rang the doorbell. And a gentleman came to the door. I didn't know who he was. I didn't recognize him. But later we learned it was Jay Sebring. And he seemed friendly. He had a black shirt on, kind of unbuttoned a couple of, maybe one extra button. Had a green bottle in his hand. Might've been some kind of a inexpensive wine, like small, like a Spignata or something like that, like 8-10-12 ounce bottle. And I just told him that I was a delivery boy from the bicycle store, that I had picked up as requested the bicycle that they wanted to exchange and dropped off the correct bicycle, left him in the garage. And he said, yeah, is everything okay? And so we exchanged maybe 25, less than 50 words. And he thanked me and off I went, got back in my van. And it was easier to open the gate leaving because the button on the inside of the property was much more prominent. So you just drive over and push that button and then drive out the gate, knowing again that it would close automatically behind me.
The tentative identification of the persons are as follows: Sharon Polanski, Jay Sebring, Abigail Folger, Wojtek Frykowski, and another man who is unknown.
For me, the evening of, and the night, late night of August 8, 1969, fortunately for me, ended somewhat uneventfully. Left Janice's house, I don't know, 12, 1230, maybe 1245, 1 o'clock in the morning, and drove back out Sunset Boulevard and then went up Benedict Canyon. So I was probably driving up Benedict Canyon about the time the murderers were driving up the canyon or heading up Portola and washing their car or washing themselves. And we lived further up Benedict Canyon, just above Portola off of Hutton Drive. So drove home that night, I don't know, 12:30, 1 o'clock, and didn't think anything of the evening before. It was really, for me, a pretty typical night. And then the next morning, I got in the van, which my dad had left me the van and ridden his bicycle to the bike shop as he'd ridden his bicycle home the night before. He often did that. It was about 5 miles. So I had the van the next morning. It's a Saturday. It's right in the middle of August in the summer. So I'm going to drive back out to Brentwood, visit with Janice, swimming pool, tennis court, maybe head to the beach. And as I'm driving down the canyon, I listen to the radio. I had the radio on all the time back then. And the music was interrupted by news about, and the details were just coming out, multiple fatalities, murder, Beverly Hills estate, and just some macabre details coming out.
In a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite, five persons, including actress Sharon Tate, were found dead at the home of Miss Tate and her husband, screen director Roman Polyansky. Miss Tate, who starred in Valley of the Dolls, was 8 months pregnant and was found in a bikini-tight nightgown.
Obviously, it was big news. I listened intently, but I didn't make a connection with where I had been the evening before. And then when I arrived out at Brentwood, waiting for me in the driveway of the home on Rockingham was Janice, and she said, "Dennis, did you hear about the murders?" I said, "Yeah, I listened to them on the radio." She said, "Call your dad right away. Your dad wants to talk to you." So I went inside and called the bike shop. My dad said, "Did you hear about the murders on the radio?" And I said, "Yes, I did." He said, "That's where you delivered the bicycle last night, and the murders occurred last night." And I said, "Wow, it said Beverly Hills." He said, "Yeah, I know, but that's Beverly Hills address. It's actually just outside the Beverly Hills city limit." And we were very aware of that because growing up, my address was Beverly Hills, California. When they had zip codes came out, there was 90210 was the zip code. But we weren't actually in the city of Beverly Hills. It was called Beverly Hills Post Office Address. We knew that Cielo was outside of the Beverly Hills city limit. So that kind of threw me off a little bit. So I said, "Oh gosh, Dad, better call the police right away and let them know what I know." And my dad said, "Not so fast, son. Let's talk about this. And this is really serious." I said, "Dad, what kind of a son do you think you raised? Somebody that would like have possibly some helpful information and out of fear or something like that wouldn't go to the police and tell them what we knew?" My dad said, "Yeah, okay, I guess you're right. Yes, that's the right thing to do. And we should always do the right thing." So I called West Los Angeles Police Department and told them that I had some information, that I had been to the scene of the murders the night before, and could I speak to one of the investigators? And I got a guy on the phone. He said, yeah, I'm the guy to talk to. I'm Sergeant so-and-so, I don't remember his name. And I told him that I delivered the bicycle, about what time, that I had spoken to a gentleman. I think at that point, I don't think I realized who the gentleman was that I spoke to. And gave him a little timeline and some action, whatever. He took it all down and said, "Okay, you'll be hearing from us." Never heard from them again. And a couple weeks later, and of course, nobody knew who committed the murders. We didn't know for a long time. Then there was murders 2 nights later. There have been another rash of murders in West Los Angeles in the year, weeks and months before this. Just an inordinate amount of murder and violence in sort of the West Los Angeles greater area. And so I think everybody was on edge. I think it was a while before, maybe some days before they drew a connection between the LaBianca murders and the murders at the Tate residence. So about 2 weeks later, me and my buddies, we're all graduated from high school. It's the last summer before going away to college. Borrowed the delivery van from my family for a 2 week drive around trip of California. So my mom made some American flag curtains for the windows, and we were kind of all American boys, but we were kind of like, gonna play like hippie van. And we drove up to Mammoth and did some backpacking and onto Lake Tahoe and then on to Yosemite and San Francisco, Mount Tam and Haight-Ashbury, and then drove down the coast of Big Sur all the way down to Newport Beach and spent a few days in Newport with a buddy of mine that had a fifth friend who had a fantastic sailboat there. And so at the end of this trip, I called my dad from my friend's house. I said, thanks for the last 10, 12 days or so in the van. And we're going to be heading home tomorrow. And My dad said, about what time? And I said, I've got to drop some guys off. Probably be there about 2 o'clock, something like that. My dad said, Dennis, it's important. Come straight to the bike shop when you're done. If you're not going to be there anywhere close to 2 o'clock, give me a call. He didn't say anything other than that. But apparently what happened was while I was off on my drive around, some police detectives came into the bike shop and they were questioning my dad. They had a receipt from that they'd found in a drawer at the murder scene where Abigail Folger had bought the bicycle, the one that my dad had delivered on Wednesday. So they're asking questions like, who was with her when she bought the bicycle? What did they look like? Did they look like they were under stress or strain? Was there a third person hanging around? And they were asking my dad all kinds of questions about Wednesday afternoon. And at some point my dad said, I just find it very curious that you're asking all these questions about what I saw on Wednesday afternoon when you haven't bothered to call my son back, who was there at the murder scene delivering a bicycle at 7:30, 8 o'clock that night. And they go, what? The what? So apparently the message never got through. So they said, well, we want to talk to your son. So I remember arriving at the bike shop and I park in the back and walk up to the front of the bike shop. My dad's there. And he said, son, you'll want to meet these two gentlemen. So they're two guys dressed in suits and they introduced themselves as police detectives. And at the gas station right across the street, they had a car parked. It was like some Chrysler product with the black sidewall tires and the quarter hubcaps. Looked like a plainclothes cop car. So they invited me to get in the car with them. I got in the back seat. And they said, so we understand that you talked to Jay Sebring the night of the murder, shortly before the murders. And at this point, I don't think I knew whether the murders occurred at 10 o'clock or 9:45 or midnight. I wasn't quite sure of the timeline. And maybe the investigators didn't know the exact timeline at that point either. So I said, yeah. And they said, how do you know it's Jay Sebring? And I said, well, I've seen a lot of pictures of whatever. I know it's Jay Sebring. And they said, okay, well, just for confirmation. And they reached over the back of the front seat and handed me a picture. And they said, so this is a picture of Jay Sebring. Just for the record, would you please identify him? And I said, no, that's not the guy I talked to. I'm sorry. We have the wrong picture. And they handed me another big picture. And I said, that's not the guy I talked to either. And they said, oh, gosh, somehow there's some confusion here. So they handed me like a binder that had like six pictures on a page. And I'm flipping through and I don't know, page 3 or 4. I go, oh, that's the guy I talked to. And they looked at each other and they said, okay, yeah, that's Jay Sebring. So they're just trying to see if I was maybe making a story up or whatever. And so they began debriefing me on, what did I see? What did I say? Et cetera. And so that led me, into the investigation and prosecution. And I didn't really obviously have much detail, but I think the main thing that the prosecution was trying to do is they're going to try and take the murderers through a timeline that could take them to the scene at the time of the murders and the victims and paint a picture that brings them together at the same place at the same time. And as I said, when I drove through the gate, I looked very carefully for anything to drive over, and there was nothing there. And I could swear with complete certainty that I'd looked very carefully, and there was nothing there. But in the morning, when the maid Winifred Chapman arrived, the phone cables had been cut and draped across the driveway and across the gate. And so, and then I think they matched the striations on the cut phone cables to a pair of wire cutters that they found later. In the investigation out at the Spawn Movie Ranch. And they matched the striations. But a defense attorney, I guess, could say, well, maybe the cable was cut the day before, or maybe it was cut that morning, or something like that. So I could just testify that when I left at about 8 o'clock, there were no phone cables cut. And when the bodies were discovered the next morning, or when the maid arrived the next morning, they were definitely draped across the driveway. And so that was the main piece of the puzzle that I could help the prosecution bring the timelines together in that way. So looking back on it now, 50 years later, 52 years later, and maybe what this might have meant to me or how it might have affected me, I do remember in the near term, certainly before we knew who had committed the murders, and we lived in a almost secluded cul-de-sac, just a couple miles away further up Benedict Canyon. So we didn't have like immediate neighbors, or it wasn't like a big busy neighborhood. And so, you know, what had been a pretty relaxed upbringing, I don't think I ever owned a key to the front door of our house until about this time. We began locking the door. Never had a key. We always knew where the keys to the car were. The cars were always parked out on the street in the cul-de-sac, and the keys were always in the ignition. So it was a very naive or innocent kind of way to grow up. If I needed to get gas, I'd pull into the gas station across the street, and the guy would come out, put gas in my car, whatever, and I'd drive off. And once a month or so, he'd walk across the street and tell my dad how much money was owed for gas that month, and my dad would pay him. It was just a very relaxed, a trusting, we didn't think about crime until this time. And things changed. Yeah, when the dog barked, you paid a little bit of extra attention. Each of the kids got a key to the house. We were expected to lock the door when we left. And so there was a little bit of attention. I do remember being home one night, walking down the hallway. We had four of the boys' bedrooms, and the house was dark. I might have even been coming home all by myself, except for the dogs that were there. And I heard the dog bark or growl or whatever, and I thought, oh my gosh. You know, and it just made me think about things that I hadn't thought of before. But of course, we're 18 years old, and so we're invulnerable. So you maybe it's a little bit more adventure, or maybe awareness, but not, I don't remember having a feeling of undue vulnerability or fear. And then in the near aftermath, I got involved in the investigation and in the trial a little bit. And so that occurred when I was about a year later. So I was a freshman at UCLA. I'd finished my freshman year at UCLA. And so some of my fraternity brothers would, I think it was Officer Ferguson was the guy that was a point of contact for me. So every once in a while, there'll be a joke about, Officer Ferguson's on the line. They have some questions for you, or something like that. So there was a little bit of lightheartedness, or maybe a gallows humor associated with it. But for some reason, just even my relatively cursory involvement, just it interests a lot of people. A lot of people wanted to hear the story, still do. And so over the years, I don't know, maybe it's at night, somebody's telling a story, somebody's talking about a crime, or somebody says, oh, Dennis, I thought you were a lawyer. You're not a lawyer. What was your first involvement with the law? And then I would go, well, interestingly enough, my first involvement with the justice system was testifying at the Charles Manson murder trial. And that would always get people's imagination or get the conversation going or whatever. So I wouldn't say that any sense of fear or insecurity followed me. Maybe a little bit of sort of interest and notoriety. Obviously, I read all the books and happy to talk to anybody about it. I think if it was more stressful to me, if maybe I was closer to the victims, or maybe like Bill Gerritsen or something, it would be so traumatic I wouldn't want to talk about it. But I think it's always been probably any good friend of mine or neighbor or friend would eventually hear about the connection. But I don't think that had any scars or any anxiety or tension for me. More sort of a point of interest.
When your father dropped the bike off that Wednesday, did he have a story? Who did he converse with? How did that go down? Do you remember that story by any chance?
I don't think he interfaced with anybody. That may be why the wrong color bike got dropped off. He just went up there, didn't see anybody, put the bike in the garage, drove off.
What became of the two bikes, the one on Wednesday and Friday? Do you remember that? Was it any of them kind of saved or entered into any kind of evidence, anything like that?
No. What would have happened to the one that I picked up? It would have gone into the van, and we had like bungee cords and hooks. So as I picked up the van, picked up the bicycle and put it in the van, we would strap it to the inside of the van. The seats were generally removed. And so it would be bungee cord to the side. And then whenever the van went back to the bike shop, then somebody would go take the van, take the bicycle out and put it, probably make sure it was clean and everything and put it back on the showroom floor. So I don't, I believe I drove straight to Janice's that, that Saturday morning. So that bike was probably still in the van and ended up back out of the bike shop sometime later on Saturday. As far as the bike that that had been purchased, I have no idea what happened to that. It was fully paid for. And it would have become the property of the, you know, the family of the victims.
Noise.
I've always wondered about Bill Gerritsen. Obviously, everybody has. You know, how could a guy have been right there on the property and not have seen or heard, or at least heard, what was going on? Myself, personally, obviously, I'm very familiar with the cul-de-sac, the gate, the driveway, the garage, the gate to the front lawn, the front lawn, the front porch, and everything else. But I, until seeing pictures later, didn't really have a feeling for, obviously you could see it was a ranch style house and it kind of rambled along. But then as it sort of bent around and now there's a swimming pool and at the far side of the swimming pool, a guest house or caretaker house, I wasn't even aware of what that was out there. I didn't know if that was 300 feet away or 100 feet away. So I didn't really have a feeling for that. It just seemed odd or unlikely that there would be gunshots or screams, and that they were heard maybe by a neighbor and by some neighbors as the sound travels through the canyons some distance away, that they would hear, but somebody right there on the property wouldn't hear. Now, the property does wrap around, so it wasn't like he was like right across from the front door, from the front lawn. So obviously it's perplexed everybody over the years and how he didn't hear it, but I think it's very possible. I guess I would also have the question of, if he didn't hear it, probably because he was playing music loudly. I think that that was the case. But then why wouldn't the murderers have seen lights on, music, loud music coming from another guest house on the property, and either trying to make sure there was no witness or maybe just an increase in what was already a killing spree. It just seems odd that they didn't notice him and he didn't notice them. I think that's probably one of the big mysteries. The other big mysteries, there were so many other murders at around that same time. And I'm not sure I have these details right, but I do remember I went to Uni High for summer school. I also went to Loyola High School in Los Angeles for high school. But for summer school, I picked up some classes that we didn't really have at my school. And one of them was biology lab class. And I took that at Uni High, University High School near UCLA. And my microscope partner was Marina Habe, beautiful, beautiful young woman. You know, I never really spent the time to go back and connect all those dots, but that would certainly haunt me, that I spent, you know, 6 weeks of a summer sitting right next to somebody every day. Beautiful person. So there were just a lot of elements of this that were unsettling, other than just these prominent murders, these two nights apart. There was a lot of other creepy stories. Yeah, the day of the trial, and so I'm not sure we all testified or completed our testimony that first day. I did. But, and we all sat there on the either adjacent chairs or on a long bench together. And as I recall, we were together before that, either, I don't remember if it was some days before that, and we were being maybe prepped a little bit for a testimony, what to expect. or maybe we were in a room together that was like a visitor room or a witness room that wasn't in the hallway ready to be called into the court, but maybe it was like a lounge that you could meet, so you could arrive an hour early and have a place to sit or have a coffee or water before going out to the sort of the hallway witness benches. And I do remember there was a guy, there's kind of a, heard a little scuffle at the end of the hallway, and it was like a sheriff or bailiff or something like that said, "No, no, sir, you can't come here." And it was so bad, he was holding some guy back. And he was a photographer, and he had kind of reached around the corner and took a picture down the hallway, or kind of down across the hallway. So when I went into court, the direct was Vince Bugliosi, who's the DA, and then and that went pretty straightforward. And pretty matter of fact, there was just some points he wanted to make about no cables were cut at that time and cables were cut later, what time to arrive and leave, and it was a pretty straightforward statement of fact. Didn't take much time at all. And then the cross-examination was this well-known obstructionist attorney, Irving Kinnerick. And it seemed like you couldn't say one sentence without him sort of parsing it apart, like, you said that Jay Sebring acted normal in your interface. Like, what do you mean by normal? And I said, well, you know, he didn't seem excited. He didn't seem nervous. He didn't seem twitching. He didn't seem stuttering. He didn't, you know, it completely, without comment, uneventful. And so he had to tear every sentence apart. And he was, well, then what you're saying that he only appeared normal as far as you saw. And I said, well, how could he have appeared any more normal than how he appeared to me? Obviously, it was a little bit kind of frustrating. And maybe I came across as being a little bit insolent. Because you're sitting there on a witness stand, not that far away, you know, maybe 20 feet away, is Charles Manson giving me the stink eye. And I said, I kind of felt like Huck Finn sitting across from Injun Joe in the courtroom or whatever. It was a very unsettling kind of interface, visual interface there, just knowing what this man and his family had been capable of doing. And then after this somewhat frustrating a nonsensical cross-examination, then I think Steve Kate came back for the redirect of the rehab. Pretty straightforward, just reiterate the facts, clean them up, and I was dismissed. And so I remember it was sort of the end of the day, and they'd sent me some money to pay for my parking, like 50 cents or something like that to park. So I had to park a few blocks away. I had a little 1968 Volkswagen Bug Beetle. And so now I'm walking from the courthouse to where I had parked that morning. And as I'm stopped waiting for a light to change to cross the street, I notice that there's a box of newspapers. And that was very common. Many, many intersections would have a box. And you would put your nickel or dime in or whatever it was for the evening edition, the afternoon edition of the LA Times. You put your money in, you open up the box, supposed to take out one newspaper. I guess if I thought about it, I could have grabbed three or four. And so I grabbed the newspaper because I wanted to read the news. And there, front page above the fold, Los Angeles Times, is a picture of me. And it was, that picture is still around, me and the other witnesses. And as I'm looking at this newspaper and looking at myself, I hear this hissing sound. And I'm like looking around, I'm not sure where this is coming from. And then I look over, and across the street is about eight or nine members of the family, head shaved, wearing hippie clothing. But they were like looking at the LA Times, my picture in the LA Times, pointing it at, pointing across the street at me and giving me the evil stink eye and hissing at me. The light turns green, and I just walk to my car, only to drive to my home on a somewhat deserted cul-de-sac up Benedict Canyon, about 2 miles away from the murder scene. So there were some unsettling moments there that definitely stuck with me. But probably more of interest over the years than anxiety or torment. So that night, the night of my 18th birthday, and I'm going to take my girlfriend Janice, and we'd been dating for several months, going to take her out to a movie. I think we saw Paint Your Wagon with Clint Eastwood and Ray Walston. Interesting, Ray Walston lived right across the street from us for Rep Benedict Canyon at that time. And so I think the movie probably started at 9 o'clock. So after I delivered the bicycle, I picked her up in Brentwood and we drove out to the movie. I'm probably coming back from the movie late, like 11:30. And I remembered when I delivered the bicycle that day that there was a very secluded, there were some homes along this winding driveway, but it was very, very secluded, and there was a little cul-de-sac at the end. And, you know, like a couple of 18-year-olds or 17, 18-year-olds, I was always thinking about going someplace for some petting or some necking and kissing that where you could be have some privacy and be uninterrupted. And so I remember driving back from the movie theater. I remember distinctly. And this is interesting because around the 50th anniversary of this tragic night, Janice and I, who are still in touch, friends, she called me up and said, hey, it's been 50 years. And I've told the story dozens and dozens of times, friends and family over the years. Just wanted to make sure that I kind of had all my facts straight. You know, it's been 50 years and, you know, and so we compared notes as to what we thought we did, about what time, what we said, what we were thinking, and we pretty much collaborated with each other or coincided with each other, agreed with each other quite a bit. So as we were driving back, and I always like to take Sunset Boulevard. It was twisty and fun to drive on. So we're coming back from Hollywood on Sunset Boulevard. We're driving past the Beverly Hills Hotel. And I told her, I said, you know, there's this great place where we could have some privacy and make out and whatever. And so I turned right at the Beverly Hills Hotel on Benedict Canyon. And we started driving up Benedict Canyon. We got a couple blocks up. And she said, you know, Dennis, my dad cuts us a lot of slack back home. I don't think we should have a problem with what we'd both like to do. And so I said, yeah, you're right. So I think on Bedford or Roxbury, I made a left turn, went back out to Sunset, and headed back out to Rockingham and Brentwood. Instead of, right around midnight, driving up to the cul-de-sac at the end of 10050 Cielo Drive, turning off the lights of the car, and sitting there and possibly ending up with a similar fate to Steve Parent. And so we joked that her father probably saved both of our lives that night, because they lived in a beautiful home in Brentwood, really a mansion, swimming pool, tennis court, wonderful family, great hospitality. Me and all my friends spent countless wonderful hours out there in high school and my freshman year at UCLA. I think it just sold a couple of weeks ago for like $14 million, so beautiful home. And there was a den or a family room, had a door. And we could go in there, and there was a TV, but we didn't watch much TV. And, you know, we would be kissing and necking and whatever we did. And it's often around midnight, 12:30, maybe quarter of one, her father would walk down the hallway, the door was closed, and he would like kind of clear his throat like, okay. And if that didn't work, maybe 15 minutes later, he'd come back and say, hey, I'm gonna heat up some food in the kitchen. They were one of the first families I knew that had a microwave. I'm gonna heat up some stuff in the kitchen. Anybody wanna join me for some popcorn or whatever? And he would pull us out of the room and whatever, and then we'd have a little bite to eat or something to drink, and then he'd send me on my way. And his daughter was a very good girl. I was a gentleman. Nothing terribly serious happened in there, but just the fact that her father trusted us and gave us our privacy and let us be a kind of passionate young couple together probably saved our lives. And we both talked about that quite a bit. Because we lived so close and just further up Benedict Canyon from Cielo Drive, yeah, I would drive past it, I don't know, 10, 12 times a week going up the canyon or down the canyon. That would probably be typical. Probably a long time before I wouldn't think about what happened up that street or what would have happened if I'd turned up that street with Janice that night. So it was proximate. It wasn't like something happened out of town and I never went to Chicago for years after that. It was a scene where I was driving by it all the time. There was some time, I can't remember how long after, but I wanted to drive up and see it, or maybe I was with a friend or a brother and they wanted to drive up to the end, the cul-de-sac. I think we waited a respectable period of time. It might've been, I don't know, 6 months, or it might've been 6 months after the trial was over. It was sometime after that, driving up there. And that was particularly creepy, just pulling up outside the gate. You get these visual reminders. But generally, I'm driving past hundreds of other places dozens of times a week. And so I don't remember any big thing. I do remember driving up there with some friends many years later and seeing that it had changed. The gate was different. The house had been torn down and a new, I think, more Mediterranean style house. I think it was actually under construction. So I could see through the gate, through a construction gate that was like a Mediterranean style house was being built in its place. And then sometime after that, the more prominent solid gate. So I've driven back up there a few times. Well, I've seen quite a bit of photographs of the property over the years. And I remember seeing the Christmas lights on the split rail fence that went around the outside of the lawn. And it wasn't until many years later that I realized that especially around Christmas time, but it could have been, maybe jumped out at me because it was other times of the year besides Christmas time, that as you're driving up Benedict Canyon, there's a kind of a long straightaway where there's a big storm grain opening. And on that straightaway, you're almost looking straight up the hill at where 10050 Cielo Drive is. And I just remember seeing Christmas lights strung out across there. And it wasn't until seeing those Christmas light pictures on the fence, I realized later that probably in the years before that 1969 night, looking up and seeing those Christmas lights on that property, it was really quite a prominent property, just kind of wrapped around and just like it had a fantastic view of the city, and myself driving, seeing those lights, had a constant view of that property. Let me go down a bit of a rabbit hole here. And part of what brings that to mind is the recent film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Quentin Tarantino's dealing with this, and he recreates history as accurately as he can. And then just like Hitler being burned up in a theater in Paris, he sort of recreates history and then changes history, gives it a different ending. And so maybe I shouldn't admit this publicly, but many's the time that, I don't know, I'm daydreaming or whatever, and I don't know if anybody else does this. Gosh, if I could go back in time and do it all over again, how far back would I go and what would I do differently? I've probably gone down that rabbit hole more times than I'd like to admit. And I'd probably say I'd go back to high school because then I would have had just a little bit higher GPA and I would have gotten into Stanford, which would have been my preference over UCLA. And then I would have, learned all about Silicon Valley and computers and all that other stuff. Then I would have made the Olympic cycling team and I would have made all these changes in my life. But one of the things that, and of course it's just a fantasy, but one of the things that always sort of stopped the fantasy or gave me this perplexed situation was, if I went back to high school, what would I do on the night of August 8th of 1969? Because remember, I know then what I know now. Would I just deliver the bicycle, get out of there by 8 o'clock and just say, okay, it's just part of my experience and nothing's changed? Would I call the fire department and say, oh, there's a fire on Cielo Drive at, you know, like 11 o'clock or something like that, and have the fire trucks pull up there, and then those lives would have been saved. But I don't know, what if I woke up the next morning and found out that 12 people were killed at a different house that night because the fire trucks wouldn't, you know, they, oh, we better pick a different. And so that always haunted me. Like, how would I deal with, do you try and save somebody's life? Do you try and change history? Do you just let chips fall where they may, because what are the consequences of changing history? And I've thought about that many, many times. And then I watched that movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and then that anguish kind of went away because Quentin Tarantino rewrites it and they're burned up with a flamethrower before they get to kill anybody. So yeah, I guess if we have a fantasy, we can rewrite the story differently. But that was always kind of an interesting puzzle for me about if I could go back and do it over again. There are very few things that I would think that, oh, what, you know, what would I do different? And that was probably the main one, that like, how could you go back there and deal with that?
Just tell us, what's your life like now? How's life now for you?
So, I'm 71 years old. I've been blessed, I think, by living in the greatest country in the history of the world. Probably the best time to ever live in this country. Probably the best state in this country. We've got some problems. And I live in a fantastic community called, neighborhood called Little Italy, right near downtown San Diego. So I live in this great state, in this best city in the state, the best neighborhood, I think, in the city. I live on the top floor of a new residential building, and I get to look out over the city and the bay and the piazza, which is right out front. I live a very, very active life. I still do 100-mile bike races. I still do, last summer I did the triathlon. Last summer I climbed Mount Whitney. So I've been blessed that I'm healthy. I'm also blessed that I live in a modern world. So if something goes wrong, you can have a surgery or fix it or whatever. But very, very little has gone wrong. I probably act a lot younger than I am. I ski, I snowboard, I ride horses very aggressively, I surf. And I've just been blessed with a wonderful life. And I just hope that I can stay healthy and active and happy. And always had young partners at work. And a lot of my friends are very young. My children, with whom I still do lots of cycling events and other events, all keep me feeling young rather than feeling old. And I'm just grateful that I've lived a wonderful life, and I hope I can stay this happy and healthy.